Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. Before we dive into our show this evening, we wanted to wrap up our coverage of yesterday's primary election. It was a team effort. Zach Bernard and Araceli Gomez Aldana covered watch parties with the Republicans and Democrats. Katie Anderson and Rebecca Green were here in the studio with Andy Downs to provide coverage and analysis as results came in. Tonight, to reflect on everything that happened yesterday, I'm joined by Rebecca Green. Welcome, Rebecca.
Hi, Ben.
Mike Braun won the GOP Senate primary in Indiana. One word we hear a lot after primaries is pivoting. A candidate wins the primary, and now they have to pivot towards the general election. What's the likelihood we'll see any kind of pivot from Mike Braun in the months leading up to November?
In our conversations that we've been having in the last few weeks with people like Brian Francisco from the Journal Gazette and Andy Downs, there's not much pivoting he can do. What he has said is out there. So he has aligned himself with President Trump and President Trump's policies, saying that he was even to the right of Todd Rokita and Luke Messer. So I don't know that there's going to be a whole lot of pivoting possible. The negative campaign ads and things will probably start soon from both sides. And it'll be interesting to see how they walk anything back if they do.
You mentioned speaking with Andy Downs. What were some of his observations?
Well, obviously, we talked a lot about the Senate race. It was one of the most expensive or the most expensive race in the country this cycle. And we talked a little bit about the Democratic primary with Courtney Tritch winning over two perennial candidates. She'd take on Jim Banks in the fall. Banks has not made any mistakes. He's, you know, not a new candidate. He's been at this before, where Courtney Tritch is a political newcomer. So it'll be interesting to see how the next few months shape up there. We talked a little bit about some of the Allen County races. There was a race we didn't get to talk about, which was the St. Joe Township trustees race, which had a whole bunch of interest and attention and involving lawsuits and conflicts with the fire department. And that was taken by Sarah Nagy, whose father held the position. So that'll be an interesting race in the fall. There is a Democratic challenger for that. And it's important to the identity of a place in Allen County.
We'll have more content from IPB. But what are some of the stories that came out of last night's results that you think we'll continue to cover in our newsroom?
One of the things that we will be looking at is the impact of the two school referenda. We had a referendum at Northwest Allen County Schools and Smith Green Community Schools. Both those referendums passed. So we'll be following up in the next weeks and months to see what that means for taxpayers and for those school systems as they go ahead. They were both pitched for different reasons. So it'll be interesting to see how that is received by the community and what that means going forward. We'll also be following up on, obviously, the 3rd District congressional race. The campaign for Tritch for Congress has already challenged Banks today to 6 debates. So we'll see what happens. It's a lot can happen between now and November, and it'll be busy.
For the rest of this hour, our program will focus on the separation of powers. And the panel discussion will be moderated by Rachel Blakeman, director of the Community Research Institute at IPFW. Here's Rachel Blakeman.
I would like to introduce each of our panelists. Here we have Mayor Paul Helmke. He is the former president and CEO of the Brady Center and Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, the former president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and currently is a professor of practice at Indiana University's School of Public and Environmental Affairs and the director of the Civic Leaders Living Learning Center in Bloomington. Helmke received a Juris Doctor degree from Yale University and a BA with the highest distinction from IU. In between is Representative Phil Giaquinta. Phil was first elected to the Indiana General Assembly in 2006. He's the appointed Democratic Assistant Minority Leader and ranking member of the House Public Policy Committee. He's authored several bills, including legislation that created the funding for the Allen County Fort Wayne Capital Improvement Board. Giaquinta graduated with a BA degree from Indiana University, and he's currently a customer account manager for Fort Wayne City Utilities. And on the other end is Judge Paul Cherry. He is a magistrate judge for the U.S. District Court, Northern District of Indiana, seated at the U.S. Courthouse here in Fort Wayne. He's been a judge for 30 years, 15 on the state court bench as circuit court judge in DeKalb County, and 15 years as a federal judge. Before taking the judicial bench, he was the elected prosecuting attorney for 2 terms and was in the private practice of law. He has taught evening law classes for 32 years. Judge Terry graduated with a BA in history from Huntington University with honors and with a Juris Doctor degree from Ohio Northern University School of Law. So with that, thank you very much. Let's sort of look at where did separation of powers come from? And it actually started with the French. And the French Enlightenment philosopher Baron Montesquieu described distribution of political powers among the legislature, executive, and judiciary in the mid-1700s in the book The Spirit of Laws. And so let's read some pleasant translation of that. When the legislative and executive powers are united in the same person or in the same body of magistrates, there can be no liberty, because apprehensions may arise lest the same monarch or senate should enact tyrannical laws to execute them in a tyrannical manner. There is no liberty if the judiciary power be not separated from the legislative and executive. Were it joined with the legislative, the life and liberty of the subject would be exposed to arbitrary control, for the judge would then be the legislator. Were it joined to the executive power, the judge might behave with violence and oppression. There would be an end of everything, where the same man or the same body, whether of the nobles or of the people, to exercise those three powers, that of enacting laws, that of executing the public resolutions, and of trying the causes of individuals. So if we think back to the founding of the country, if you remember back to your high school history days, there was a concern about the concentration of power in the king in terms of colonial era. And so we had a concern about aristocracy. So a logical extension of that is to adopt this principles of having a separation of powers, dividing those to give direct responsibilities for each branch and to limit infringements by the other. So what I always think of when I talk to the high school students who are doing We the People, I always say separation of powers is the horizontal alignment of government, and federalism is the vertical alignment of power. So we're talking about the horizontal alignment of government, or as you also might want to say, it's stay in your lane government. So if you contrast this with the fusion of powers, where a parliament may hold both the executive and the legislative functions, so in Great Britain, the prime minister is elected from the parliament. And now we look at the state level here in the state of Indiana. On the back of your guide, we do have Article 3, Section 1. So we have an express separation of powers in our state constitution. We are one of 40. So clearly we are not in the minority on that, where it says the powers of the government are divided into three separate departments, the legislative, the executive, including the administrative, and the judicial, and no person charged with the official duties under one of these departments shall exercise any of the functions of another, except as in this Constitution expressly provided. And with that, I would like to start about your own, talking to each one of our panelists about their own experiences with separation of powers. So let's start with Mayor Helmke, and specifically about the strong mayor.
Well, I'm a firm believer in a strong executive at the local level. I think one of the problems with the separation of powers issue is that a lot of people think that the executive always has a lot of power. They think that the president has a lot of power, the governor has a lot of power, the mayor has a lot of power. In Indiana, mayors do have a lot of power. A strong mayor system. We don't have a city manager that's elected by the city council like a lot of larger cities do. It's interested me in contrasting the powers of the mayor to the powers of the president or the powers of the governor. As mayor, I didn't have to get my chief of police or fire chief confirmed by the city council. I appoint who I want. Unlike the governor, I don't have to have my controller approved by the voters like they do at the state level, where they elect the auditor, elect the treasurer, elect the assessor, the finance people, in effect, for state government. When a budget's approved, I don't have to spend the money. The president does. I in effect, have a line item veto. It's something, if I don't think it's a good thing to spend money on or we're running tight of funds, as mayor, I didn't have to spend it. City Council could subtract from the budget I proposed, but they couldn't add to it. So as mayor, there was a lot of power. I could veto things. It only took one more vote to override it. That was one of the weaker things. But there was a lot of power concentrated. A lot of people assume that's what it's like at the other levels, and it isn't. And I think what we've seen in recent history, and actually probably since even not just recent history, is that presidents come in and think that there's going to be power there that isn't there. And that's what the current president perhaps is sensing, that he alone can't do all the things that he alone thought he could do. We get governors that get some of those same things. So, again, strong executive I like, but I like it at the local level. And I think the fact that there are those powers sometimes for the executive confuses both the voters and sometimes the office holders when they think their office should have all that power too.
Judge Cherry.
Well, the question is, in the stay in your own lane idea of separation of powers, what have we experienced in our own lives? And I have two separate comments to make about that. One is on the issue of judicial pay, when the Congress got out of their lane. The U.S. Constitution states that the amount of compensation for federal judges may not be diminished. So the writers of the Constitution must have anticipated this to be a problem someday. It's important, of course, for the independence of the judicial branch to not have someone else have the ability to diminish our pay based on unhappiness of decisions. Imagine every decision we make every day makes some people unhappy. And so we, in theory, can't let that happen. In 1989, Congress passed an act that said that cost of living adjustments to judicial salaries are part of judicial compensation. So when they're granted, they need to be granted to judges as well. So it's both against the Constitution and federal statute to do that. Contrary to all of this, Congress granted cost of living adjustments to all other federal employees except federal judges, a carve-out as a way to punish the judiciary. So we've got the legislative branch punishing the judicial branch. They did this, Congress, in 1995, 1996, 1997, 1999, 2007, and 2010, 6 years in a 15-year period. During those years, the presidents were William Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. As a result, judicial compensation, in real terms, because we weren't getting COLAs, fell substantially over the 15-year period. Chief Justice John Roberts Jr. pointed out that it also damaged the public's respect for the judicial branch. And several Supreme Court justices testified in congressional hearings. The Chief Justice, Roberts, also Alito, Breyer, and Kennedy, saying this is illegal and it's an attack on the independence of the judiciary. The only recourse was for federal judges to file lawsuits, an uncomfortable and awkward position to be in. Three lawsuits were filed. At first, and this was during the Barack Obama years when the lawsuits were filed. At first, the Justice Department at that time fought against the lawsuits, implicitly joining in Congress punishing the judiciary. But eventually, there was a settlement reached, and some of the back pay was awarded, not all, and an agreement reached that that should not and cannot happen in the future. So that's an example in the lives of judges of how another branch got out of their lane. The other one that I wanted to mention today is presidential criticism, the executive branch. And while preparing for this panel discussion, I knew in general, of course, that some presidential public criticism occurs of the judiciary, but I was a little surprised to find out that there are websites out there. When I started thinking about this and looking into it a little bit, some websites devoted just to presidential criticism of the judiciary and public criticism of judges. And at least one of those websites displays screenshots of tweets by President Trump, which criticized the judicial branch. Originally, I thought I'd read some of the juicier ones to you today, but later I decided that I don't want to do that. It might come across like the judicial branch today doing the same conduct that we're saying the president shouldn't do. So I'll refrain from reading those, except one. On my personal individual side, I often agree with President Trump on policy issues, but the tweets and other public statements sometimes attack judges, sometimes by name, sometimes are often for specific decisions, and the tone is sometimes not civil. And sometimes he questions a judge's integrity, motives, or competence. The one I do want to read, a public comment that he made, he said, "The courts are not helping us. I have to be honest. It's ridiculous. Somebody said that I should not criticize judges. Okay, I will criticize judges." The executive branch attacks on the judicial branch are not just by President Trump or just the Republicans. They come from the other side, too. It's bipartisan. President Obama, in his 2010 State of the Union address, chided the Supreme Court justices for one of their recent decisions. Most of them were sitting in front of him as a captive audience, subjecting them to the emotions of the legislators and the public. In 2012, the Obamacare case was pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. The arguments had been heard. The decision was under advisement. President Obama publicly warned the justices to, and I quote, "play it straight when it comes to the interpretation," end of quote, of the statute. And in 2015, the Democrat-leaning Washington Post newspaper printed an editorial that's entitled, "Why Does President Obama Criticize the Supreme Court So Much?" So all I'm saying is it happens on both sides of the aisle. It's happened long before President Obama and President Trump. It's still going on. And by the way, maybe I should mention that judges, as you might realize, we sort of have our hands tied behind our backs because we're not allowed to publicly, outside of the written opinion itself, not allowed to publicly defend our or explain our decisions, and whereas others can freely criticize us. And criticism can be very constructive, but not always.
Thank you. And if you haven't already figured out that we not only have a member from each branch of government, we also have a member from each level of government, so federal, state, and local. And on the state side, we have Representative Phil Giaquinta, and he would like to speak. We thought it would be interesting to hear about the state legislative process. How is the sausage made, Phil?
Well, first of all, it's a little intimidating to be up here with Mayor Helmke and Judge Cherry. As I was discussing this with my brother Mark, his question to me was, "Why are you up there?" And I said, "I don't really know." And then he said, "Well, just let those two do all the talking. You sit back and relax and see how it goes." Well, I do have a couple things to say, if that's okay. And
you get to go back to special session, so you're not quite done. We get to see more sausage.
Yes, exactly. I've had the pleasure of serving under three governors, Governors Daniels, Pence, and Holcomb. And if I can, I just thought I'd kind of run down a couple of things that where I've seen where the branches have kind of clashed a couple different times. One thing I remember with Governor Daniels, you know, when he announced after he was elected, I think his words, Steve Schein, were buckle up. He had quite an aggressive agenda that he was wanted to push with the toll road, time change, and other things. And at the time, the House Democrats were not in a superminority, so they could do some things, slow the process down, if you will. And toward the end of the first half, the House Democrat, I was not there. I did my walk a little later, but I was not there at the time. But House Democrats left the floor, killing, I think, approximately 135 bills. Governor Daniels, I think his words were, the legislature was car-bombed today. But that is obviously one way that the legislature, if they don't see something that they like with regards to the governor's agenda, they can slow it down if you're not, obviously, in the supermajority. Mike Pence, and as well as Governor Daniels and Governor Holcomb, of course, they are required to give a State of the State address where they lay out their agenda. They work with the legislative leaders, the legislators, to try and enact that agenda. Governor Pence had somewhat of a limited agenda, but worked well with us. I think Governor Holcomb, of course, who was running for the Senate and then became governor, has had probably, I don't know if he knew he was going to end up being governor or not, but he's had, again, somewhat of a limited agenda. But I will tell you on the interesting story, on the very last night of the session this year, as things, bills were being kind of going a little slow or reprinting them, trying to get some things passed. As you saw, the headline was "Session Ends in Chaos." And before that, though, about 5:10 till midnight, Governor Holcomb came running up the stairs with an executive order wanting to extend the session by a couple of hours. Well, you're not allowed. You can't do that. So Senator Long realized that, Speaker Bosma realized that as well, and just said, Governor, you got to go about this a different way. You're going to have to call the legislature back. You got to start all over again if you want to continue to hear those bills. So that's kind of one, I think, another example where the legislature sort of put a stop to something or the executive branch wanted to do. Mayor Helmke mentioned the veto. The governor has a veto power. We have simple majority override of 51. We actually upheld the governor's veto in this session from a veto last year with regards to public records request, and we all supported him on that. So obviously, sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. With regards to the judiciary, there is a State of the Judiciary speech every year. They, of course, have their agenda where they work with the administration and the legislature. You mentioned the fines case. I'm still $3,500 lighter in the wallet because of that, but that was something, again, where we were able to demonstrate and walk out the legislature and slow down a couple of items that we disagreed with House Democrats, I'm talking about, with regards to right to work and some education reform policies. Those things were eventually passed the following year. Interesting, and I'm glad my brother isn't here, but most of the Haller Colvin firm is, so I know this is all going to get back to him anyway. But the argument was stated that you can fine someone, but you can't collect. And the Supreme Court decided that we're going to stay out of that issue. And one of the questions I thought that was asked, I believe, by Loretta Rush to the state attorneys was, does this mean that you could take their house? And the answer was, well, yes, they could if they wanted to. So that was a position where the Supreme Court basically kicked it back and said, we're not going to get involved, and allowed the fines to go forward. The other one was recently the Community Action Coalition tried to get some information, some email from, it was a chairman of the Utilities Committee, Representative Cook, some dialogue and emails that he had going back and forth with some folks. I don't remember exactly what the bill was, but I don't know if it was with lobbyists or whomever. But again, Citizens Action Coalition sued and wanted those documents, and the Supreme Court basically again stayed out of it and said that's a private matter between the legislator and their constituent or the folks that they are doing business with. So those are just a couple examples I came up with regards to separation of powers.
The conversation will continue on WBOI Presents after a short break. Stay tuned.